rise.
The court is ready to hear argument in 060755, Freymeyer Engineering Company versus Jomar International.
May it please the court, Mr. Smith will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Stuart Smith. I represent the petitioner, Freymeyer Engineering Company, by and through Liberty Mutual Insurance Company in this matter. This case is before the court on an appeal of simply one issue, and that was whether or not the trial court erred in granting the respondents traditional and no evidence motions for summary judgment. At trial, the respondents asserted traditional no evidence summary judgment on three grounds. The first ground was that petitioner didn't have standing to sue. The second ground was that petitioner's claims were barred by the rules of contribution. The third grounds was that there was no evidence of causation, either proximate cause or producing cause. The Court of Appeals didn't address the last two elements because they affirmed on the standing issue, and this case is now before this court. In looking,
so if you were to prevail on that issue, the case would have to go back for review of the other two issues.
Exactly.
Your Honors, in looking at this case, the thing that, first of all, jumps out is that if the Court of Appeals is right that my client made a voluntary payment in this case, I would want you to notice that the contract that my client was operating under paid my client a total of $128,000. The loss in this case was $458,000 and some change. So if the Court of Appeals is right that my client made a voluntary payment, then my client literally accepted $128,000. And by the way, that wasn't profit. That's just simply money they accepted for the job, you know, out of which they take their expenses. But if we look at that, then the Court of Appeals would hold that we accepted $128,000 for the privilege of paying out $458,000. I would suggest to you that common sense would tell us that obviously we didn't do that voluntarily. We did that pursuant to a contract. And the contract is germane to this case, and it's important because it satisfies the second element of the doctrine of equitable subrogation, that is, that the payment has to be made involuntary.
Is this any different from an insurance company paying the damages from a loss resulting from for its insured and then later trying to seek subrogation against the manufacturer of an alleged defective product?
The principles are equal, and that is that here the payment that was made pursuant to a contract, just like an insurance company made payments pursuant to its contract of insurance.
In those contracts, there's a subrogation clause that specifically gives the insurance carrier the right to subrogate on behalf of its insurer. Is there a similar clause in this contract?
There isn't, but
does there need to be one for an equitable subrogation claim?
Absolutely not. There's language in the in petitioner's brief that talks about how this court has recognized that there's no boundaries to the elements of subrogation. In other words, the doctrine of equitable subrogation is not limited to a specific context, but the courts have said over and over again that in any context where equity demands that when someone pays a debt for which someone else is primarily liable and the person who pays that debt didn't do so voluntarily, then they can avail themselves of the doctrine of equitable subrogation.
Is there still a dispute whether the valve was defectively designed? We never have gotten to that part.
Well, that's what's important about the case, this case, is that since it's an appeal of a summary judgment, when we look at the traditional motion for summary judgment, the standard is every reasonable inference has to be indulged in favor, must be indulged in favor of my client, and the evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to my client. And when we look at the no evidence, the only burden my client has is to present something a little bit more than a scintilla of evidence that there's a material issue of genuine fact. And when we look at the record here, this whole case turns on the fact that there, if respondents were to prevail, they have to establish as a matter of law that my client was a tortfeasor. And that's interesting because the only evidence in the record concerning the installation of the ADA-valve was my client's experts who said that the ADA-valve was installed properly according to the manufacturer's instructions. There is no, you will find no statement from a manufacturer's rep from the respondent saying that the valve was not installed properly. In fact, you won't find any statement from any witness or any claim from any witness that the valve was installed improperly.
But if they're right on the law, on their basis for summary judgment, it doesn't matter. They're not basing their contention, as I understood it, on whether or not the valve was defective, but just that you don't have this subrogation right. Am I wrong about that?
Well, the two are related because it goes to whether or not we paid a debt on which they were primarily liable. The cause and fact, according to the record, in fact, you'll find the uncontroverted evidence in the record, is that the cause and fact of this loss was the defective valve. Our expert's testimony that the valve was defective is not controverted by any other evidence in the record, nor is there any claim by anyone that the valve was not defective.
But your CGL policy paid to cover Freymeier when Freymeier was not negligent, or
yeah. That was, and Your Honors, this is outside the record. That issue was not raised at the trial court. However, we were never asked to produce the policy or coverage or questions were not brought up. If they were brought up, what would have happened was that you would have seen that that policy, in fact, was endorsed to provide contractual liability coverage for Freymeier service contracts. It is true as a general principle that general liability policies don't provide coverage for contractual liabilities, but as Your Honor knows, a general liability policy can be endorsed in countless number of ways, and in this case, it was endorsed to provide coverage.
But we don't have that in the record.
It's not in the record, but neither was it raised in the record that there was a lack of coverage. The Court of Appeals misapplied this court's decision in Smart versus Tower Land and Investment Company. It's in the brief, but basically the Court of Appeals quoted this language in Smart that equitable subrogation may be invoked to prevent unjust enrichment when one person confers upon another a benefit, and the Court of Appeals highlighted this language that is not required by legal duty or contract. The Court of Appeals then went on to seem to argue that, or seem to find that because we had a contract with Renaissance and with the general contractor for Renaissance, that therefore we made a contract payment pursuant to a legal duty or contract and violated this dicta language from SMART. But the problem with their application is that language is referring to a debt between the equitable subrogor and the debtor, not between the equitable subrogee and the equitable subrogor, which is the debt between or the contract between Freymeier and the Renaissance Hotel in this case. If we were to follow the Court of Appeals reasoning, we would in effect never ever have the doctrine of equitable subrogation because it would be impossible to prove the second element of subrogation, that is, that the payment must be made involuntarily. But the Court of Appeals further misapplied Smart, because when you read through Smart, you'll find that the court, this court, talked about the doctrine of equitable subrogation, but the reason why they declined to let Tower Land and Investment avail itself of the doctrine in this particular case was because the mortgage contract in that case expressly precluded personal liability from Mr. Smart for unpaid property taxes, which was what Tower was seeking to be reimbursed for. But the discussion in that case is very germane to this case in that it helps us answer another question that the respondents raised in this case, and that is the respondents said, well, another reason why you can't apply the doctrine of equitable subrogation in this case is because in this case, you, the equitable subrogee, paid money directly to the equitable subrogor instead of paying money to someone else on behalf of the equitable subrogor. And the respondents alleged that that had never been done before. But in this court's discussion in the Smart versus Tower case, this court actually set forth a laundry list of cases where, in fact, that's been done. It's been done in the context of the mortgagee-mortgagor situation, where the mortgagee is seeking reimbursement for taxes, property taxes that's paid from the mortgagor, and this court set forth a laundry list of cases where that was allowed, and in those cases, the mortgagee pays the property tax directly to the taxing authority, who is in effect the equitable subrogor. The mortgagee then steps into the shoes of the taxing authority and subrogates against the mortgagee. That's exactly.
Was your client liable in tort to the Renaissance Hotel as well as contract?
In short, no, Your Honor, and you'll find that there's no evidence in the record to support that. The only claim of negligence made by the respondents against us is that the valve was negligently installed. And again, when you review the record, you'll find that the only evidence on that issue...
I mean, to Renaissance. Even if you hadn't agreed to contractual indemnity, Renaissance could have sued you, your client.
No, not in tort. No, sir.
Because... You can negligently install valves, and wherever you negligently install them, you're not liable for it?
The only evidence in the record is that the valve was properly installed according to the manufacturer's instructions.
Well, but it's product liability. I mean, you installed a product, too.
Right.
And product liability, there's damage to other property, the rest of the hotel.
Right.
And so that's a tort.
Yes, Your Honor. That is the tort, and
I'm trying to help you, not hurt you. I think.
Sure.
I mean, the CA said, "Oh no, this was just some voluntary contractual liability." But if you hadn't signed for indemnity, and you go in there to repair a pipe and flood their hotel to the tune of $500,000, you're liable in tort, whatever your contract says, aren't you? Or was there some disclaimer or something that was involved in this case that meant? Freimeyer was not liable in tort to the Renaissance?
There's no evidence that Freimeyer was liable in tort. There's no evidence that the valve was not installed properly. There's no evidence that the valve was negligently installed.
But if you installed a defective product, you would be liable for it, whether you were negligent.
Not necessarily.
Whether you were negligent or not.
The defect might be, it could be a latent defect. It could be something that isn't discoverable. I would disagree that we would necessarily be liable just for the act of installing a defective product.
But if you were liable in tort, you'd be settling joint tort fees.
Well,
And therefore, your claim would be barred by contribution, Texas contribution law. Is that not correct?
Perhaps, although in the Kecht case, that's not the approach that this court took, because in the Kecht case, the excess insurer, the primary, the excess insurer asked to sue the primary insurer under the doctrine of equitable subrogation. The primary insurer made a counterclaim saying that the excess insurer had comparative negligence. And in that situation, this court did not hold that the excess insurer was barred from or had no standing to sue under the doctrine of equitable subrogation on the basis that contribution rules were being violated. What this court held is that those issues should be submitted to the trier of fact. The excess's own negligence should be submitted to the trier of fact as a defense to the doctrine of equitable subrogation. And presumably, depending upon how much responsibility was assessed to each party, that would then determine whether or not the doctrine was viable.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Ms. Casada will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. My name is Hillary Casada, and I represent Jomar International on this in this case, but I'm here today arguing on behalf of both respondents. I'd like to, in my time before the court, as well as answer any questions you have, I'd like to focus on really the main issues in this case as respondents see them, that and boil this down to what this case really is. This case is not an equitable subrogation case. This is a case where we have a party seeking to avoid its freely and voluntarily bargained for contract liability under the guise of equitable subrogation.
And then the manufacturer of a defective product should get a free pass on these type of cases?
They should not get a free pass in these type of cases. However, they should not be held, Your Honor, to a contract that was negotiated without their input, that was negotiated based on the general contractors. The Freymeyer made this contract in order to hedge its bets, in order to make sure that, you know, it could get this contract, make some money, and then
it
be...
Its indemnity didn't agree to anything other than it would have been liable for it common commercial law, right?
It said that it would be indemnify Renaissance for any and all claims.
They're putting in a water pipe. If the water pipe busts and floods the place, they have to pay for it, even if whether there's an indemnity contract or not.
Well, I agree with you in that regard, Your Honor, that in this case, our first contention is equitable subrogation doesn't apply because the debt we're dealing with is this contractual debt that they bargained for. However, they also could have been sued exactly like you asked the petitioners. They could have been sued by Renaissance in tort. They could have been a joint tortfeasor in this case.
But if they're right that they were an innocent retailer, then they've got a statutory cause of action against you. You're right. Joint tortfeasors can't get contribution in lots of cases, but if they're an innocent retailer selling a defective product, which I understand is precisely their claim here, of course they can get. State legislature says so, but before that, the common law said so.
But that's not what they've done here. They have...
Well, the whole deal of the Court of Appeals opinion is somehow this was a voluntary undertaking, that they just volunteered, we'd like to make the Renaissance Hotel happy. That's not... Nobody had ever contracted anything before. Renaissance would have done exactly what they did, say, pay for the damage you've done, and they would have turned around to you and say, pay for the damage that your product that we installed is. I'm trying to understand why anybody thinks they volunteered.
Well, they volunteered in this case, quite frankly, because they contracted with Renaissance to cover these types of claims and these types of damages.
And you honestly believe they wouldn't have owned Renaissance a dime but for the contractual indemnity?
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm saying at all. It's just in this case, it didn't get to the point where Renaissance picked its tortfeasors, picked its defendants, and sued.
And equitable subrogation doesn't require that you wait until the lawsuit's filed and we pay the lawyers $100,000, and okay, well, now it's not voluntary anymore.
But equitable
subrogation... I mean, you can settle knowing you're going to get sued, right? And still get equitable subrogation.
In the right context. And in this context, first... The first step you have to do is show that you were primarily liable, that you settled
a debt. Who else
would
have been liable for this flood?
Well, that's not the debt that we're looking at for equitable subrogation. The debt we're looking at is the contract debt.
Not my question. Who else would have been liable for the flood?
Well, in this case, there could have been the installation could have been negligent. There is actually evidence in the record that if the issues had been the merits and the liability aspects, which they weren't at the summary judgment phase, if they had been, there could have been more evidence brought in. But even if you look at the admissions on Clerk's Record of 31, Renaissance inserted that Frymer was responsible for the property damage. They admitted that. It's not limited to only contractually liable. That could be tort liable. The experts themselves, specifically Spruell, the second expert that you'll find at the clerk's record at page 149.
Let me ask you, if the hotel were damaged and it's not Frymeyer's fault, let's just assume.
Okay.
And it was not the installer's fault, it was the manufacturer of the product manufacturer's fault. And the contractor stands to the loss and says, okay, it happened on our watch, we were there, we'll pay you. Why shouldn't the product manufacturer have to cover that loss because it was really their fault?
Because the issue of equitable subrogation is that would be an expanding the doctrine of equitable subrogation that I don't think this court or any Texas court has contemplated in this case. This is different from the excess insurance situation.
I don't see how it is expanding. If you see the debt as the debt that the product manufacturer owes for the loss, if that's the debt, then the contractor is answering for that debt, the debt of another. Why shouldn't he be able to recover against that debtor?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree that that's the debt we're dealing with. And I think that's where the parties have really been kind
right.
of confused throughout this, both sides.
And that's the part I'm having trouble understanding. Because it seems to me obvious that the debt is what the person who causes the loss owes the person who suffers. And it seems to me that's the debt. And if that's the case... then it looks to me like this is classic subrogation.
Well, Your Honor, it seems that this is kind of a circular argument. Our contention is that the debt at issue was the contractual debt and obligations and liability that Frymeyer on its own contracted with Price Woods and thereby Renaissance as part of the process of getting this job. If, on the one hand, if you look at the debt that way, this is a contractual debt, and it was only Frymeyer's debt. Joe Marr and Mixer were not parties to that contract. They were not parties to that debt. However, if you take it out and say the debt's this tort, the damage from the water damage, they still don't get, unfortunately, in this situation, back around to where Joe Marr and Mixer are then liable. And that's because if you're looking at it as, well, they extinguish this tort debt, well, who are they standing in the shoes of?
How about this? If the hotel's own insurance company had ponied up money to make the repairs, could they have gone after your client?
I haven't thought about that. If the hotel's insurance company had gone ahead and paid, yes, in that case, that would have been...
How is this any different? Insurance, you say that the voluntary contract with Price Woods defeats equitable subrogation. But insurance companies every day of the week seek subrogation based on voluntary payments they made under insurance contracts they voluntarily entered into.
Well, the main difference is that here Frymeyer settled with Renaissance. They did not pay on behalf of Renaissance. They're not an insurance company. Frymeyer is not an insurance company. And in the insurance context, the insurer and your...
Well, but the indemnity contract only said Freymeyer and Renaissance decide who's going to get the insurance to cover this. Okay, you're going to get it. Why is that any different than if Renaissance had gotten it?
Because in this situation, the insurer, if you were going to make Freymeyer the insurer in this case, which is...
No, Freymeyer's insurance company. Liberty. Freymeyer and Renaissance both have insurers. They say, who's going to get the insurer? So you get, we'll pay you this much, but you get it. Okay, we'll get it. So they get it. But why is that any different than if Renaissance had got it?
Because in the Renaissance context, Renaissance, their insurer would not have been part of the causation at all. And in this case, you've got a situation where Freymeyer is a potential tortfeasor. They installed the valve. An insurer in the typical context is subrogated to the insured on whose behalf it paid. Here, it's Freymeyer contracted with Renaissance to get a job. They were hired by Renaissance. And then they were told, you have to get insurance if you're going to enter into this. And they did. And the insurance covered the loss. Renaissance was, for all we can tell from the record, fully compensated for the loss and also released all claims related to the loss. So at the end of the day, which I think gets us back to a little bit to Justice Heck's question, is at the end of the day, even if you're saying this debt is the tort debt, which we disagree with. We say when you have to go through the process of figuring out whether or not equitable subrogation applies, you have to look at what the debt is. But even assuming the debt is the tort debt, that debt's been taken care of. And that brings us around to the issue of contribution and the issue of assignment. And
well, I want to ask you about that in just a second. But it's odd that if you think that if the hospital, I'm sorry, the you had the hospital case earlier. If the hotel's insurer pays the loss, it can seek subrogation from the manufacturer because the debt is the manufacturer's debt to the hotel. But if the general contractor pays the loss, it can't because the debt is not the manufacturer's debt. I don't see how the debt shifts depending on who pays the loss.
Because in the former, if Renaissance filed suit, claimed that they were going to file suit, and the insurance companies got involved, at that point in time, all the potential tortfeasors, Freymeyer, Jomar, Mixer, whoever they may be, could then say, you know what, we want to settle this. And at that point, they're joint tortfeasors being sued by the original plaintiff. And the plaintiff in this case should be Renaissance. And in this situation, I think a good example, an analogous example, is the International Proteins versus Purina case. I think I know it's not exactly, because we're not dealing with a construction contract in that situation, but it is directly on point in that this court specifically said that the settling defendant tortfeasor can't get contribution from the other defendants. And there were problems with, and the court recognized that, you know, allowing equitable subrogation in that context caused problems at the trial. I mean, there were dual roles and dual hats, and that's exactly what would happen in this case.
Well, of course, that's a problem. But I've never been sure International Proteins was rightly decided, or Jenkins, or even Bonneville. But maybe it's just because I don't understand them. But does it make any the one distinction between this case and those cases is that one of the possible joint tortfeasors has a contractual obligation to pay the plaintiff. Is that distinction important? It's one thing to say, well, we don't want the joint tortfeasors arguing among themselves, suing each other over who owes the plaintiff what. But if one of them has already paid the plaintiff because of contractual obligation, then you don't really have that argument.
Well, and I think that's where from respondents' point of view, the petitioners have been talked really out of both sides of their mouth, and why I think this argument gets very confusing and circular, because at the end of the day, that's the only difference between this case and Smart and Jenkins and Purina is that the settlement happened before any suit was filed, before anybody said, aha, you're a joint tortfeasor. And at the end of the day, if they are permitted to stand in the shoes of Renaissance, they're going to have the same dual hat problem that we've had in these other cases.
What evidence is there in the record that Freymeyer acted tortiously at all? What specific record evidence is there of that?
Specifically, Your Honor, the main evidence is in the form of the Spruell, and I'm looking for that right now. Clerk's Record 149. Spruell, one of the experts, discusses the installation of a separate ball valve next to the ADA valve. And while at the end of the day his assessment is, hey, that could have caused extra torque, but more likely than not, it wasn't that large of a problem and a discrepancy. That evidence, Spruell's entire expert report goes through and talks about the installation process, the decision to add this separate valve. There's also evidence that it was unclear whether or not the instructions were followed in terms of shutting everything down, shutting the pumps down in this situation. There were also questions that I think Spruell's expert report goes through where they talk about there were 12 different valves that they reviewed. The one that failed was the only one that only had the sticker sealant in rather than the hard sealer plus the sticker sealer adhesive. And so if that was fleshed out down the line, if you got to the question of liability on the merits, there would be evidence that this is a joint tortfeasor situation. Now, at the end of
the argument is that doesn't matter, right?
Correct.
Even if it were conclusively established that it was all Jomar's fault, bad design, the way this was set up, they're not entitled to contribution or subrogation or anything.
Correct, Your Honor. That's exactly right. In this case, they've set it up where they contracted with Renaissance. They paid under that contract. Now they come to the court and say, we want to be able to act like Renaissance, even though we're not Renaissance's insurer. We didn't owe Renaissance any duties before we entered into this contract to indemnify them or to sign them, even though we've decided on our own to enter into this. Now we want to allow to get paid under the doctrine of equitable subrogation from these manufacturers.
But just so I'll be clear, under the question the Chief Justice just asked you, if you lose that, you still have the position that even if there is a cause of action, we don't owe it because we didn't do anything wrong. Is that true or not? You still say that the valve was not defectively designed or...
That really wasn't discussed in the record, but I would assume yes. If we got to that point, that's what we would be, without doubt arguing. But in this case, they've set it up wrong. This is an equitable subrogation question, and they cannot be equitably subrogated. Plus, it's a
what should they do? What should Freymeyer have done if it wanted to make things right with the hotel? But it didn't want to pay for something it wanted to be reimbursed from the real culprits.
It probably shouldn't have contracted from the beginning for the indemnity.
It seems like it's kind of perverse to encourage people not to agree to pay damages.
But at the same time, on the flip side, Your Honor, we would argue that it's not appropriate, it's not equitable to expect and allow the contractor to then be able to say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and hedge my bets and I'll pay you if anything happens, because then I'm just going to be able to get reimbursed from these other folks.
Doesn't that wipe out equitable subrogation for all insurance companies?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't, because in this case, because in the excess insurance situation,
I'm not primary insurer. A primary insurer agrees by contract to pay somebody's damages that they didn't have any responsibility to pay. They just entered a contract and said, we're going to pay your debts for you. And if you're right, then we've been wasting time giving insurance companies equitable subrogation for years and years and years.
I
voluntarily entered into this contract to pay somebody else's debt. How foolish of them.
But in the insurance context, there are all of these other duties and case law and jurisprudence that make the concept of equitable subrogation and these questions of whether or not something was involuntary.
The only thing the Court of Appeals held was when his client agreed to take on this indemnity, they voluntarily entered into a contract, so no equitable subrogation error. That's exactly what an insurance company does when a liability insurer does, primary carrier, when it signs an insurance contract.
But in Texas, there's a
that
presumption.
Is exactly what they do.
Well, there's a presumption that when they do that, it's an involuntary payment. And we're saying that presumption should not be extended.
Why is that any different? Why is the contract they entered with Renaissance any more voluntary or less or an insurer than an insurer's agreeing to give somebody liability insurance?
Because in that situation, the insured I think you have to, if you take that, you have to assume that in this scenario, Freymeyer is the insurer. And we get back to the whole concept of if Freymeyer is the insurer, they're potentially liable. And in the typical insurance realm, your insurer is not going to be a tortfeasor. Your insurance company is simply the company that's said, okay, if you do something wrong, we're going to cover it, knowing that then we can then go against anybody else that may have done that. That's not the hierarchy that we have
in
this situation.
Assume the facts are crystal clear, undisputed. This product is the culprit. This product was defective. It caused the accident. We're talking about equity and equitable subrogation, and how does letting a manufacturer of a product that is indisputably flawed, how does letting them escape scot-free put the equity and equitable subrogation, or it just seems in conflict?
My time is up, Chief Justice. May I answer the question? I think that's with all due respect, kind of a sky is falling kind of mentality, where that wouldn't necessarily happen. In this case, Renaissance could have sued Jomar and Mixer, and they would not have gotten off scot-free. Now, there would have been arguments to be made that they had been made whole.
Their insurance company could have sued them as well. You said earlier, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Smith, were you all suing for contribution or indemnity?
Our action would be more akin to indemnity, Your Honor, because we're saying the whole thing was your fault. We're not saying give us part of it back because we were partly at fault. We're saying we weren't at fault at all. You caused the whole thing. We had to pay it because of our contract. So the action would be indemnity, not contribution.
Indemnity action, you don't have a joint tortfeasor problem.
That's correct.
Since whoever's bringing indemnity has to show that they weren't a tortfeasor.
That's correct. And I would also agree that the cases, we talk about the doctrine of equitable subrogation, the cases that this court have decided that are very closely analogous to this case before you now are the primary and excess insurer cases. Because when you look at those cases, you have a contract with the excess insurer and the insured. You have a contract to which the primary is not a party to. Just like in this case, you had a contract with Freymeyer and Renaissance that the respondents were not a party to, okay? And the excess makes a payment under that contract, and this court has held that's not a voluntary act. That's pursuant to legal obligations in the contract.
I suppose if your contract had said, we'll pay you your loss, and because we treasure your business, we'll add 10% to that. You couldn't expect the product manufacturer to pay for that 10%.
No, that would be that would be correct. But again, going back to that excess primary insurance equitable subrogation cases, the court has also noted that when the excess pays under its policy, when the damages have been inflated by the primary's mishandling of the underlying litigation, that payment, that involuntary payment under the contract, has the effect of extinguishing the debt that the primary should have paid in the first place. And therefore, in equity, the excess may sue, has standing to sue under the doctrine of equitable subrogation against the primary. That's exactly the same type of case we have here. My clients paid a contract to the hotel involuntarily, pursuant to their legal obligations of the contract. That that payment had the effect of satisfying the cause and fact of the loss, which was the defective valve. And therefore, in equity, my client should be able to step into the shoes of the hotel and sue the respondents to recover those monies.
Counsel, does your position change? The Court of Appeals says there's no evidence that Renaissance made any demand upon your client to recover damages. They just made a demand under the contract. That's what its opinion says. Do you agree with that? And my question is going to be, if the demand on your client was simply a demand, court demand, does that change your position?
Well, I think our position is the demand that Renaissance made to us was to honor the contract.
The contract.
Which
says... That's all, the Court of Appeals says that's all the evidence in the record.
And I would agree with that.
Okay. So this is not you didn't pay any wise under a tort.
No.
At all.
No. And I would also direct Your Honor's attention. It's not true that in answers to the defendants or the respondents' admissions that we said that we admitted to some sort of tort liability. For instance, their admission number four was that admit or deny that no property owned, leased, or rented by Freymeyer suffered any damage as a result of the October 12, 2001 repair work and installation of the Adeval product. Our response was admit, however, Freymeyer had a legal obligation to pay for the damage even though it was not at fault in causing the damage because of its contractual duties. Therefore, Freymeyer was not a mere volunteer who paid the damages but had a legal obligation to pay for same and is entitled to the benefit of the doctrine of equitable subrogation. So we did not just give unqualified admissions on those type of questions, but we did qualify our admissions very specifically to make it clear that we were availing ourselves of the benefit of the doctrine of equitable subrogation.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and that concludes the arguments for today.